Good morning. It's my pleasure to be able to introduce Dr. Beverly Roberts-Gaventa to you this morning. Beverly, if I may be so bold to have a degree of informality inserted here, was born and raised in West Tennessee. She didn't quite go as far as Tarshish to take her BA in Enid, Oklahoma at Phillips University. She went there, though, as a dutiful member of the denomination she grew up in, and that's the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. She did, however, move back to the East Coast to finish her Master of Divinity degree at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And then she went on to Duke University for her PhD, studying under the pivotal Paul scholar W.D. Davies. And since 1992 has been the Helen H.P. Manson Professor of New Testament Literature and Exegesis at Princeton Theological Seminary. And to make just a sort of small little sort of remote connection, she succeeded in that chair a Dr. Paul W. Meyer, who was my first advisor when I studied at Princeton Seminary in the mid-80s. The list of Beverly's publications is very long. As you can sort of guess from the brochure that you have in front of you, she's the author of numerous articles, books, reviews, preaching resources. And in those works, she displays an impressive scholarship for the church. She is indeed an ordained lay elder of the Presbyterian Church USA. She's also the editor of many volumes. Her commentaries include a commentary on Acts, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and she's currently working on a commentary on Romans in the New Testament Library, and you'll want to keep your eyes open for the release of that volume in the future. She has a very delightful, accessible volume titled Our Mother, St. Paul, published in 2007, where she explores the meaning and significance of the maternal images that Paul uses to describe his ministry, correlating these images to the main contours of what scholars call the apocalyptic shape of Paul's theology, which we will learn a bit more about today and tomorrow. In that very interesting volume, in fact, she has a delightful little excursus or chapter which she titles, Is Pauline Theology Just a Guy Thing? And she answers, no. She is the author of Mary, Glimpses of the Mother of Jesus, 1995, and in that sort of thematic connection has also co-edited Blessed One, Protestant Perspectives on Mary, and The Child in the Bible, 2008. One of her earlier publications includes From Darkness to Light, Aspects of Conversion in the New Testament, which came out of her doctoral dissertation written under W.D. Davies, which was explored the dynamics of the conversion of Paul. She's a member of many academic and professional societies and has served in many leadership capacities in those societies, and she's also served on numerous editorial boards of scholarly journals. When I discovered the kinds of courses she's taught at Princeton Seminary currently, I was sort of struck by a couple of things that you might be interested in. For instance, she teaches a course called Women and the Letters of Paul. And she also teaches a course or co-teaches a course called Paul and Carl. Now, that's a delightful little sort of ambiguous title, but it's co-taught with a systematic theologian, Bruce McCormick, who has an interest in Karl Barth. And so the course actually explores Paul's Romans in connection with the commentary in Romans that Karl Barth authored some years ago and was decisive for 20th century theology and beyond. Among her many professional and scholarly accomplishments, Dr. Gaventa has also made it on YouTube. Her lectures have not quite gone viral yet, but they are very, very impressive. And if you were to Google Beverly Roberts Gaventa, you would find two lectures delivered in March of this year at the United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. And one is titled, Listening to Phoebe Read Romans. And another is titled, Listening to Romans with Junia and Her Sisters. And if you have a chance, you should check these out. It would be a great supplement and complement to, I think, what she will deliver to us in these 2 days. This is her first visit to Winnipeg. I'm so happy that she's chosen very good weather in which that could take place. We wish you a very warm welcome. Hope that it stays. And we look forward with delight to your first lecture, Unable to Help Ourselves, in the larger scheme, From Powerless to Praise, in Paul's letter to the Romans. Welcome.
Thank you very much for that lovely introduction and for your welcome. I'm very glad to be here. As I mentioned to several people already, my husband and I spent 11 years in Rochester, New York, so we know some parts of Canada east of here rather well, but this is my first time in Winnipeg. Sometime in the late 50s of the first century of the Common Era, a woman by the name of Phoebe, who's just been mentioned, traveled to Rome from her home in Cenchrea, the port city of Corinth. We know very little about her. She was what we would call a Christian, although, of course, the term was not yet in use. Apparently, she was a leader in her community of believers. She had been a benefactor of Christian mission and was able to travel to Rome, so presumably she was a person of some financial means. She went to Rome with a letter from the Apostle Paul. And when she arrived in Rome, she worked her way from one small gathering of believers to another. To each one, she read the letter. That was that other lecture. If you wanted the justification for what I just said, you can go to YouTube. When she finished reading, or perhaps even while she was still talking, the discussion began. Two millennia later, the discussion has not abated. To my knowledge, Romans has not provided subject matter for great works of art, unless we include a few portraits of Paul himself. I am aware of very few musical settings of the end of Romans 8, but little beyond that. Poets rarely engage lines from Romans, although I'm going to mention an example in a moment that I happen to like a lot. The letter's influence, nonetheless, is simply enormous. It has been commented on, taught, preached, and discussed almost without end. The history of Western Christianity is tangled up with the interpretation of this letter. We have only to think of Augustine and Luther and Calvin and, closer to our own time, Karl Barth. In the last 50 years or so, however, there's been a rather testy rejection of some of those classic lines of interpretation, as a number of scholars have insisted that Romans is not a treasure chest of theological themes. It is instead a real letter concerned with reconciling different believers, Jewish and Gentile believers. Or some have argued that it's a fundraising letter for Paul's mission to Spain, or even a kind of self-introduction intended to disarm certain criticisms of Paul's mission. In my own work on Romans, I try to respect both this recent insistence that we have a real letter addressed to real people about issues in their community, but I also want to respect the traditional insistence on the theological importance of this letter. To put it much too briefly, I think Paul wrote this letter to communities at Rome who were largely Gentiles, people who were, as he saw it, who understood the gospel primarily as their means of access to membership in Israel. Many, maybe most, of these Gentiles came from what we used to refer to as the God-fearers. That is, they were people who attended Jewish synagogues and were familiar with and attended to Jewish teaching, but they had not become full proselytes. I think of them as synagogue groupies. Some of them may even have thought that they had replaced Jews as the owners of Israelites' tradition. Here I'm thinking of some specific lines in Romans 11. Paul writes to help them understand that full inclusion in Israel is only part of the gospel. The gospel is more than their inclusion. It has to do with God's radical invasion of the world as it is, a world that is captive to larger than human powers and can be redeemed only by God's action. In that sense, Paul's understanding falls squarely under the heading of apocalyptic. Now, I'm not going to demonstrate all of that in three lectures, so you can take a deep breath. What I want to do instead is to try to sketch the basic framework of the argument, which is that God rescues a humanity that is unable to help itself. As a result, humanity moves from powerlessness to praise. So this morning we start with his depiction of humanity. I mentioned a moment ago that Romans exerts relatively little influence on poetry, but I also mentioned an exception, that of W.H. Auden's poem, For the Time Being, his Christmas oratorio. It is a long poem, some of you will know it. It carries us across the whole sweep of the infancy narratives of Matthew and Luke, sort of like a Christmas pageant for grown-ups, and it is for grown-ups. Among my favorite moments in the poem is the free verse reflection of Herod, who is contemplating what he takes to be the disaster of the baby's birth. He contemplates the need to save civilization by launching the massacre of the innocents. And he comments, and this is on your handout, every criminal will say, I like committing crimes. God likes forgiving them. Really, the world is admirably arranged. Now, Auden imagined this scene and sneaked it in between lines of Matthew's gospel. But to me, at least, the connection to Romans is unmistakable. At 6:1, Paul writes, as we heard a moment ago, what are we to say then? Should we continue in sin that grace may abound? Auden's Herod voices this conviction. This is exactly what will happen. And in fact, this is not simply my imagination at work here. In the poem itself, Auden has this line from Romans 6 as the epigraph of the poem. Should we continue in sin that grace may abound? Every criminal will say, I like committing crimes. God likes forgiving them. Now, there's only one problem with the way Auden has used Romans 6. Paul, notice, doesn't use the word forgiveness. He doesn't say, should we sin that we may be forgiven, but should we sin that grace may abound? And it's not only here that Paul does not use the word forgiveness. Paul's letter to the Romans has virtually nothing to say about forgiveness. There's one exception in Romans 4:7, and that's a quotation from Psalm 32. The same is true of his other letters as well. Paul almost never speaks about repentance or forgiveness, except in one case in 2 Corinthians where he's talking about human beings forgiving one another. Now, that comes as something of a surprise to a lot of people. Concern about divine forgiveness dots the landscape of the Old Testament, which itself plays a more prominent role in Romans than in any of Paul's other letters. Abraham negotiates with God to forgive the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah. Moses pleads with God to forgive the Israelites for crafting their own gods. Leviticus and Numbers detail the practices required for forgiveness. The Psalms seek God's forgiveness and express gratitude for its outpouring. Isaiah and Jeremiah plead with God not to forgive the people. And then, of course, they anticipate the day of God's forgiveness. In the Jesus tradition, talk about forgiveness is hard to overlook. John the Baptist preaches a baptism of repentance for forgiveness. Jesus says to the paralytic, your sins are forgiven, maybe your sons too. The Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. The Acts of the Apostles attributes language of repentance and forgiveness to Peter and to Paul. But in Paul's letters, this language seems to have slipped out of sight. Now, commentaries on Romans sometimes don't even notice this, so you'll find the word sprinkled in the discussion. I suspect that's true of most of us. We simply read what Paul says and assume that he talks about repentance and forgiveness because we expect it to be there. Most commentators on the letter simply ignore speculating on the silence. One commentator who does have something to say about it is Jimmy Dunn, J.D.G. Dunn, who suggests that Paul wants to establish his own technical vocabulary. He wants to use terms that are usable and understandable, but he doesn't want to make use of Judaism's language from the sacrificial cult. Now, I have to confess, I don't find that a very satisfying explanation. It sounds as if Paul is sort of self-consciously creating Christian talk, a kind of Christian brand, so he can distinguish himself from his Jewish neighbors. But more important, Paul extensively uses Jewish scripture and Jewish language throughout this letter. And that's even still an odd way to put it. Paul is a Jew. That's the way he speaks of himself. In my judgment, it's not that Paul is self-consciously using different terms for the same thing, nor do I think this is just a quirk in his vocabulary. I think that the word forgiveness turns out to be too small to do justice to Paul's understanding of the gospel. After all, when we speak about forgiveness with respect to God, what we're suggesting is that you or I or we all have done something wrong for which God forgives us. But what if the problem is larger than that? What if it isn't just that I have done something wrong, but that I have been unable to do anything right? What if I am in the power of another ruler, and I cannot do what is right because I am enslaved to that ruler? How can I do what is right? To make things worse, does forgiveness in that circumstance even do me any good? I may have been forgiven for a specific act or series of acts or a whole course of my life, but I remain a slave. I think that's why Paul speaks not of forgiveness, but of liberation from enslavement, of new creation, and of divine welcome. Now, what I'm about to say is not very fashionable in the circles of Pauline scholarship. It is far more fashionable to argue that Romans is all about God's history with Israel, or that Paul is preoccupied with questions of ethnicity, conflicts between Jews and Gentiles, or that Romans was written to counter the power of the Roman Empire with the power of God. But a great deal of what we find in the first seven chapters of this letter, nearly half the letter, is preoccupied with the power of sin. Not just Gentile wrongdoing, not just Israel's disobedience, but sin. And sin here is not only a lowercase act, a transgression, an act of disobedience, but an uppercase power that has humanity under its thumb. Paul's argument about the state of humanity under sin unfolds across the first half of the letter. In at least three stages along the way, he makes comments about the situation of human beings prior to the gospel, before the action of God in the cross and resurrection. First, he presents a scathing indictment of those people, unnamed, for their bad behavior. Second, he reflects on the story of Adam, in which Adam provides the entry point for sin and death. And third, he writes that before the gospel, human beings were enslaved to sin and death. Now, there are some tensions in this argument. It is not entirely logical by our standards, but it is, I think, coherent. And it leads finally to my summary, we are unable to help ourselves. Now, I want to say a bit about each of these stages in the argument before taking up his understandings of the divine response, and finally some implications, both ancient and modern. And again, the handout has some of the texts I'm going to refer to if you want to look. You should always look and see what Bible scholars say, because sometimes we say a text says something and you might think it doesn't. And that might be because we're wrong. So, initially, this is stage one. In the first half of Romans 1, Paul offers an indictment of human disobedience that is cast in third person. Those people. He begins with a general statement about God's judgment on human beings. God's wrath is being apocalyptically revealed from heaven against every ungodliness and wrong of human beings who suppress the truth with that which is wrong. By way of explaining what he means by this, he claims that God has been revealed in creation, but human beings, here they, those people, deny the truth about God. Notice, God's wrath is revealed against every ungodliness and wrong of human beings who suppress the truth. The truth that's suppressed here, as he goes on, is God's own work as creator. Humanity refused to honor or give thanks to God, and engaged in idolatry, and thereby lied about God. That is, the basic human rebellion against God has to do with worship, with withholding worship and corrupting it into the worship of the self. This is a point I'm going to come back to tomorrow morning to talk about worship and its place in this letter. As a result, Paul says, God handed them over. Now, this is an expression we find in a wide range of ancient texts, including the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. We find it, not always, but very often, in settings of conflict, when someone or a group is being surrendered to the power of another. God handed them over could even be translated as God surrendered them. Paul makes this same statement three different times. God surrendered them to impurity, verse 24. Verse 26, to degrading passion. Verse 28, to a debased mind. The repetition tells us something about how important this statement was for Paul. It is in this state of having been handed over, surrendered, that he says they commit this long list of reprehensible actions identified at the end of the chapter: murder and envy and disobedience. Now, that's not to overlook the initial action. Human beings refused God's lordship. And that refusal triggered a handing over to a different lord, here named impurity or passion or a distorted mind. Now, one oddity of this passage is that it makes no reference to time or to the people involved. When exactly does this take place? It doesn't say. Who is the they Paul is castigating? He doesn't tell us. The charges, especially the charges of idolatry and sexual immorality, sound very much like conventional Jewish characterizations of Gentiles. Now, when I say that, I always have to say Gentiles said very nasty things about Jews. It's not just that Jews were the ones engaged in stereotyping. We should know that from our own experience. Still, in the Wisdom of Solomon, late first century before the Common Era, we find language that sounds very much like Romans 1. All people who were ignorant of God were foolish by nature. They were unable from the good things that are seen to know the one who exists. Nor did they recognize the artisan while paying heed to his works. Notice the parallel there. They should have known, but they didn't. They didn't recognize God. Many scholars would agree that Paul is here making use of this popular anti-Gentile polemic that runs a little bit like this. You know how nasty those Gentiles are. They will worship anything. They will sleep with anyone. They will eat anything. Food doesn't come into this text, but it might have. And that doesn't preclude there being Gentiles in the audience, since Paul's Gentile audience likely understood themselves to have cast off the ways of their neighbor and to be identified with Jewish colleagues instead. So, it is entirely possible, to go back to Phoebe reading the letter, it's entirely possible that some people who heard Phoebe read this letter nodded their heads in smug agreement as she read the sharp condemnation of other people. To me, that makes total sense because so many of Paul's readers today continue to nod in agreement as if the argument had nothing to do with them or with us. Of course, just afterward, at the beginning of chapter 2, he springs a trap on this impulse to condemn others. 2:1, who do you think you are, condemning others, when you actually do the very same things? Then he engages in a complex argument that undermines the very categories of Jew and Gentile, as it patiently shows that no one is exempt from the charge of rebelling against God. Finally, over in 3:9, he writes, all, both Jews and Greeks, are under the power of sin. Because it is not possible for anyone to be right with God, God has acted in the death of Jesus to make things right. Now, at this point in the letter, along about the end of chapter 3, the beginning of chapter 4, a first reader or hearer of the letter might imagine that Paul is done with the question of sin. We've done that, right? Chapter 4 discusses God's promise to Abraham. Chapter 5 opens with beautiful language about hope and peace because of the Christ event. We think we're out of the woods. And indeed, many treatments of Romans characterize chapter 5 as Paul's discussion of the Christian life. But he's not done yet talking about sin. I think of this as a spiral that takes us further and further down the further we go into the letter. In the second half of chapter 5, after talking about how we have peace with God, now it's first person plural, we have been reconciled with God, the discussion of sin comes back. Here Paul turns up the volume by introducing a long and complicated comparison between Adam and Christ. Now, the legacy of Paul's comments about Adam and Western Christian thought is enormously important and complicated. If you would like to see a good discussion of that, I would send you to Ian McFarland's recent volume, In Adam's Fall, particularly on Augustine. In some respects, what Paul says here is rather simple. Adam's action, Adam's disobedience, allowed sin to get into the world. And when sin entered, it brought death along with it as a sort of toxic partner. His language here is striking. Both sin and death serve as the subject of a series of verbs, and I've highlighted these. Sin entered the world. Sin increased. Sin ruled as if it were a king. In the same way, he writes, death also entered and extended its reach to all people so that all sinned. Death itself ruled as a king. Elsewhere in Paul's other letters, I'm thinking of Philippians 1 and 2 Corinthians 5, he seems to look ahead to his own death as the opportunity to be with Christ. But here, death is something more like a power introduced into the world by sin. Excuse me. Sin opens the door so that death can come in, and together they reign. Here, unlike chapter 1, Paul doesn't speak of some vague they, a category that at least might exclude me, might include other people, but not me, not us. Here he speaks of all. Death pervaded all people, all sinned. Verse 18, the sin of one person brought condemnation for all. In the same way, the right act of one person brought righteousness for all. One way of summarizing this stage in the argument is to say that because of Adam, all of humanity has lived under the rulership of sin and death, thus producing more sin and more death as a consequence. Because of Christ, all of humanity has been redeemed from their grasp. It is grace, that is Jesus Christ, who now rules. Again, by the end of this chapter, a first reader or hearer might think, well, we've gotten to the end of this discussion of humanity and sin. And then it gets worse one more time. At the beginning of chapter 6, Paul asks that question that Auden plays with. Does the new rulership of grace mean that human beings can continue to sin? Are we now home free, so to speak? Can we do what we want without consequence? It may be that Paul has been accused of being a libertine, as some think. It may be that he simply raises this question, which he takes to be absurd, in order to move on to say that those who are baptized are joined with Jesus' death and share in his new life. He then reinforces this point by contrasting the old life with the new. As he does so, he uses a yet more intense image, so we're down to the bottom of the spiral now, for the place of human beings prior to Christ. He writes in verse 6, you no longer are slaves to sin. He repeats that point a little later on. Don't you know that you are slaves of the one you obey? Either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. Later on, he says, you presented your members as slaves to impurity. And again, you were slaves of sin. What he does here, in a sense, is simply to unpack what he's already said about humanity living under the reign of sin and death. If these were kings, they were not benevolent rulers. But the introduction of the language of slavery intensifies the discourse considerably. I'm going to come back to this tonight to talk about the violence that is implicit in this language, but for now I simply want you to notice it. Okay, so we have moved from they rejected God to all became citizens of a kingdom ruled by sin and death to you were enslaved to sin. That language of slavery extends into chapter 7, where Paul writes in the first person singular, I am sold under the power of sin. Now, whoever the I is, and people have been debating that question at least since the 4th century, sin enslaves even this one, the one who has tried to do the law, who has tried to keep the law's commands. This means that the argument has moved now from they to all to we to I, before finally in chapter 8, Paul turns away from this topic. Taken together, what comes to expression here is a conviction that humanity is quite unable to help itself. Human disability is perhaps less dominant in chapter 1, where human beings make a choice against God, but that very choice leads to their disempowerment, to their being handed over. By the time we get to the Adam-Christ discussion in chapter 5, there are only two human beings who make a choice, who take an action. One is Adam, and the other is Christ. And their actions have the effect of carrying all people along with them. Now, lest we all droop here under the weight of despair from the unrelieved pessimism in what I have said, I want to remind you that there is another, a different, and a very important strand of argument in these chapters. That argument has to do with God's action. In the opening lines of the letter, Paul writes that the gospel is God's way of bringing about salvation in Jesus Christ. He doesn't say exactly what he means by that, but as the letter moves along, he draws on several different images. In chapter 3, he identifies the death of Jesus with redemption, terminology that's used elsewhere of buying back those who have been enslaved. In chapter 8, he writes of God's adoption of humanity and of the anticipation, again, of redemption. In chapter 14, he says that Christ welcomed humanity for God's own glory. I'll have a lot more to say tonight about God's role in this story, but for now, I want to return to some questions about this view of humanity. First of all, what is it that drives Paul to this view? This is a very hard question, and I think we should admit at the outset that we cannot answer it. As the heirs of Freud, I suspect most of us will reflexively start to look for some psychological explanation. His mother did it, you know, or his father did it or something. Those are speculative in the extreme. You know, when I think of how little I understand the makeup of the people who live around me, I am even more reluctant to credit psychological interpretations for individuals two millennia removed. But among Paul's contemporaries, there are a few who voice a comparable view of human incapacity. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, we find a text in which the speaker declares himself to be a foundation of shame and a spring of filth, a melting pot of iniquity, a structure of sin, a spirit of error, perverted without understanding, and terrified by righteous judgments. In 4th Ezra, written in the late 1st century, the speaker is so disturbed by the state of humanity that he cries out, O Adam, what have you done? It was you who sinned, but the fall was not yours alone, ours also who are your descendants. At least these texts suggest that Romans is not totally idiosyncratic. But they don't answer the question of why, what is it drives Paul to take this position? If pressed, I would say that Paul's reasons are probably more theological than they are psychological. In this letter, perhaps more than anywhere else, except maybe 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is pointing to, he's grabbing for ways of talking about the size of the gospel. As he articulates the immensity of what God has done and will do for humanity and all of creation in Jesus Christ, I think he comes to see and to express the human problem in ever more negative terms. Second, how did this unrelenting description of human disability sound at Rome? Now, we have absolutely no way of answering that question, but it's nonetheless one I like to think about. I suspect it may have been fairly unwelcome in some quarters. For people who wanted the gospel to be simply an entry card for Gentiles into Israel, this would have been an odd, even perhaps offensive thing to say. For others, it may have been a genuinely liberating word. Almost certainly, a number of the people to whom this letter was initially addressed were themselves slaves, or at least the descendants of slaves. These are people who know their own powerlessness. And Paul's insistence that they share with others, with freed people, perhaps even their own owners, that they share powerlessness may have been, in a sense, liberating. Third, to a question at least we can think about together, how does this portrait of human disability sound in our own ears? Is there any sense in which this is good news? Now, I know from experience that the language of sin itself is troubling for some people, even for those who are serious practicing Christians, because of the kinds of moralizing baggage that the word carries around with it. Quite apart from the word sin, as heirs of the Enlightenment, many of us don't much want to think about our own powerlessness. To say that humanity is enslaved to sin and can only be freed from sin by the power of God is to admit that we do not have the power to help ourselves. Now, I've been teaching Paul a long time. People have a lot of things to complain about in Paul's letters. I suspect the thing that most offends most people is this notion of the enslavement of humankind, because it runs so directly counter to a modern Western notion of human freedom and autonomy. It runs counter, particularly, you know, I'm thinking south of the border here, to an American notion that we can just do a little better, and then we will be better. Acknowledgments of powerlessness prove especially problematic for women. Claims that God has power strike us as projections of human power, especially destructive male power. Nonetheless, I think that despite these problems, Paul has something to show us. Let me try an analogy. Paul's understanding of human life under the reign of the anti-God powers looks quite a bit like what we know about the horror of the child soldier. In many parts of the world, children are swept from their villages and off the streets or traded by their parents who are desperate for food. They themselves become little more than slaves. Girls who are used for kitchen duty and sex. Boys who wield weapons. In many cases, they are forced to become soldiers, and not just soldiers, but eventually to become captors of others. There is no escape. In much of this situation, there is no thought of escape. The family is destroyed. It's replaced by an unrelenting ideology that takes control even of the thoughts. These people, these children, cannot help themselves. They can only be rescued. The only power they have is the destruction of themselves and others. Child soldiers can only be rescued by loving power. What Paul is showing us is that we are all, in some sense, among those child soldiers. In such a context, power is not to be rejected, especially when it is the self-giving power of redemption. Finally, I think the most important thing Paul urges us to hear in this is the gospel, as I've mentioned before, in its vastness. The vastness of what God accomplishes here is far larger than the word forgiveness usually suggests. What we need to hear is Paul's understanding that the gospel encompasses the whole of the cosmos, the whole of creation, all the way out and all the way down in human life. Thank you.
We're going to take a few minutes and give some opportunity for questions. There are microphones on two aisles here, and we would ask that you've got questions to come to the microphone, introduce yourself, and then ask your question.
Hi there, my name is David Drieger. Thank you for the input this morning. I was looking forward to, at the beginning you said, talk about some contemporary implications, and so you talked about analogies. And so for me, as I was listening, it seemed to be very clear to me in terms of living in the midst of a structure of sin in which the possibility of doing good seemed an impossibility as an individual or a community as a result of that. And so for me, the analogy was to think of perhaps people in another part of the world or in another part of our country hearing this letter with the initial they being basically kind of speaking of those with the structure of kind of late Western capitalism, in which I think for most of us with any sense of middle classness have a certain position within there, in which I personally feel and hear a strong sense of, well, my actions are, as a result of my structure, are devastating, are part of a system that mm-hmm. is devastating. And I'm just wondering if you would comment on that analogy, and then further to that, the idea of the gospel as a release. What I was also wondering about is, to what extent is Paul's claims sort of ontological or spiritual in a negative sense? When he talks about this as actual, is it in some other realm?
Okay.
And how do we engage with that?
This is a cheap ploy, but actually that second question is the one I'm talking about tonight. So if you don't mind, I'm going to hold off on that. The first question, yes, there. I actually cut some things because I realized I was going a little longer than I meant to. But I think there are many ways in which we can look for analogies here. There are devastating ways in which, you know, every day we run into complications where I think that the following action I'm going to take is helpful for the environment, but in fact I realize that it's counterproductive. You know, there are all of those kinds of situations in which we are shaped. We are almost without a sense of knowing what to do because of the complexities. What I want to try to avoid is making this into a they that is cut off from me. That is to say, it's very easy for me to say the Wall Street bankers are the they and the rest of us are innocent. I didn't hear you saying that, but I think there is a tendency in all of us to do that.
Just to follow up on that.
Yeah.
I think I'm off here.
Yeah.
Because when I talked about initially talking about the letter being heard in another place, that I would be the they
yeah.
that is overheard
right.
there, and,
yeah.
and how do we
Absolutely.
Start possibly hearing it in
right.
that?
Right. I think Paul's, you know, the hard part about this is it's not for me to say to anyone else, you must hear it this way, right? But I think when this letter works, you know, we finally, by the time we get to chapter 5, we all know that we are all implicated, no matter where our situations. There's nobody, in Paul's view, there's nobody who's innocent, totally innocent, who's without influence by this web of power. That's very hard to say.
Hello.
Hi.
I am curious about. Oh, I'm Gabrielle. Hi. I'm curious about the implications of talking about the saving work of Jesus in greater terms than just forgiveness, or what we usually associate with forgiveness. The implications for that on atonement theology, mm-hmm. and especially since there's a lot of imagery. Like I think particular Romans 5 is mm-hmm. There's a block of text there that is often used to talk about atonement, and I just thought you might have some good thoughts.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question. I think our atonement theology, and I guess I'm speaking for the traditions out of which I come, has too narrowly understood this, as I see it, as a kind of Jesus' death on behalf of sin in place of a guilty humanity. And one of the things I was pointing to very all too quickly there is that you get different kinds of language at different points in this letter. In some sense, it is a death in place of, but it's also a death that is redeeming. That is to say that it takes humanity. I mean, I do think there's a kind of battle here. I'm going to talk about that tonight. That there's a kind of taking humanity out of the power of sin and death. I think there is a new creation motif here, that humanity is genuinely liberated to not just to restored, but actually recreated, so that the work of Jesus' death for Paul is a rich complex of varying images. That is, you know, again, I would say, you know, that forgiveness turns out to be a much too small word. It's included, I suppose, but forgiveness, what's needed is a kind of, for him, liberation altogether.
Thank you for a very delightful lecture where you've drawn not only on the classic theological themes, but also doing an alternative to the traditional Protestant take. For instance, able to talk about Romans 1-8 without even referring to making right, which mm-hmm. is quite impressive, and the suggestion that forgiveness is really an insignificant theme. What would be interesting, and I really value your emphasis on liberation, recreation, and mm-hmm. divine welcome. These are sort of the forgotten themes. At the same time, there's so much going on in these chapters,
yes.
and how can one talk
right.
about everything? But for a moment...
Yeah.
How might you think about how at least the theme of divine mercy flows through these chapters, from the divine forbearance of chapter 1, chapter 3, the mercy theme of chapter 9, chapter 11, taking away of sins in 11:26. There's that little bit, and I'm just wondering briefly how that sort of theme
yeah.
sort of matches, or isn't it sort of is partly a minor expression of the predominant imagery of liberation, recreation, and divine welcome?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't exclude it. I mean, you do have those texts that you mentioned in one, in two, and in three use different vocabulary than what you get in 9 through 11, where you do get language of mercy. I've been impressed by an argument that Susan Eastman at Duke makes, that Paul uses mercy language specifically when talking about Israel. And the clear reference to mercy comes in Romans 11, rather than back earlier where it's forbearance, which is a little more difficult. In general, I would say that all of these fall under the heading for Paul of dikaiosune, justification, righteousness. I prefer to say rectification, that is to say, the making right of what's gone wrong. But I think where I have a slight problem with some of Protestant tradition on this is I think we have looked only at one strand of the language here and not looked at the larger imagery. I think that, like apocalypticists generally, he draws on different imagery in order to grasp at this thing that is larger than our experience. So to reduce it, you weren't doing this, but to reduce it, as some people do, simply to legal language or forensic language is, to me, to foreshorten it, which goes back sort of to your question as well.
Dr. Gaventa, thank you very much for introducing these lectures in this way and for introducing the Book of Romans in this way. Thank you very much.
You.